It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back on Monday. Still ahead, a new development in the state budget debate might affect the outcome of the UW's future autonomy. We'll learn about that and a staff buyout at UW-Eau Claire in just a few minutes. First, it's time for our weekly roundup of state news. Two stories dominated the headlines this week: the shooting death of Madison's Tony Robinson, who was killed by a police officer last week. That's a continuing story this week. And Monday, Wisconsin became the 25th right-to-work state in the country. The AFL-CIO and other unions challenged the law in courts earlier this week. WPR's assistant news director Noah Ovshinsky joins us now to talk about these stories and other headlines from around the state this week. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here. Good afternoon. And as always, Veronica, happy Friday.
And I extend that also to you, Noah. And a lot's happening this week in Wisconsin.
Wow. It has been an intense week in the news for Madison in particular. As you mentioned, 19-year-old Tony Robinson was shot and killed by a Madison police officer last Friday during some kind of confrontation. Robinson was unarmed at the time. He is black. The officer, Matt Kenny, is white. And really every day since then, or nearly every day since then, there has been some kind of protest or rally of some kind. They have been passionate and emotional, but so far largely peaceful in nature, and the police have really given the protesters a wide berth, giving them lots of room to protest.
And the details are different, but there have been comparisons made, or at least the temptation is there to compare Madison to Ferguson. What are we hearing about that?
Right. And of course, there's a timing issue with all of this. And of course, Ferguson, Missouri, that's where a young unarmed black man was killed by a white police officer. And as I said, you know, the timing is really interesting here, because the shooting in Madison and its aftermath is all playing out as eyes are once again on Ferguson, with the shooting of two police officers there, the resignation of the police chief, and the release of a scathing DOJ report that found, basically widespread racism within the Ferguson city government. So both of these happening, news organizations, of course, drawing parallels between the two. Even if there aren't many, really, if you get down to the details.
And speaking of the details, a lot of them still under wraps. Where does the investigation stand right now?
Attorney General Brad Schimel says his agency, the DCI in particular, and the DOJ, is continuing to investigate the shooting. He says there are 29 agents working on the case, and that they're making their way through, you know, essentially hours of video and interviews with 60 witnesses. So this is still very much an investigation that is ongoing.
And the public is still waiting for this information, as you just said. Any word on when some information might be released to the public?
Right. So Schimel said the probe could take another 2 weeks. He says really no information will be released about that investigation until a report is passed on to the Dane County DA, who will make the final determination whether charges are warranted. Schimel argues that releasing the information piecemeal essentially does more harm than good. He says it would be a disservice to the search for truth if they released information about the investigation, you know, every few days or so forth. Now, we just heard in the newscast that the initial autopsy results have been released, although that doesn't offer many more details than what we already knew, which was Robinson was shot several times by the police officer, but not much detail beyond that.
So another 2 weeks, it looks like, for something to emerge there. And Monday was a big day. Wisconsin became the 25th right-to-work state. What happened?
Right. So Governor Walker signed the right-to-work bill on Monday. And really, Monday capped, I'm trying to search of a word here. I would call it probably whirlwind, I would say, a legislative whirlwind, where the bill was announced, introduced, debated, and voted on all within a matter of maybe just a few weeks. It happened very, very quickly. And of course, during that time, it was the subject of a few protests and rallies and that sort of thing. So the signing this week really, you know, capped that episode.
And remind us what right to work, what the law does.
It essentially bans mandatory union membership or mandatory dues paying in the private sector. Supporters, including Republican legislators and the governor, say really it's a matter of workplace freedom. It's giving workers the option whether or not they want to pay these dues or join a union. They also say it will make Wisconsin more attractive to companies looking to move and bring potential jobs. Critics on the other side say it will lead to increased workplace tension, you know, between those who are unionized and not unionized, or those that pay dues and those that don't. And they also argue it will eventually lead to lower wages. And as you indicated here in the introduction to this segment, it may not be over. At least the news part of all this is because several unions have, in fact, sued to stop the implementation of right to work. So stay tuned on that one.
And Scott Walker has been in the news quite a bit lately because, he hasn't officially said he's running for president, but it kind of seems like he's running for president. And there are polls, checking out what would happen if he did run for president.
Yeah. So as you know, and as we've talked about on the show, I'm always sort of lukewarm on polls. I sort of groan when we do them. But occasionally we do have to talk about polls. And this is the first poll in a while. With a presidential primary campaign sort of heating up, I think it's worth looking at numbers like this, especially when it involves, our governor. This latest poll was conducted by the left-leaning Public Policy Polling Organization, or PPP for short, and it found that Governor Walker's approval rating in Wisconsin has actually dropped 6 percentage points to about 52%, and that is since last October.
Why do we see Walker's support eroding, seemingly, at least according to this poll?
Charles Franklin, who conducts the Marquette University poll, which we talk a lot about on the show, he was not involved in this poll, but he says the governor is solidifying his support among Republicans, but actually is losing ground with independents and moderates as debates here in Wisconsin continue over right to work, the ongoing budget battles, and in particular the budget battles regarding the proposed cuts to the UW system.
Now, the same poll also looked at a potential matchup between Governor Walker and Hillary Clinton in the presidential race. What did it find there?
It had Governor Walker trailing by 9 points among registered voters, and that's in a race with Hillary Clinton.
Is this the first poll of this kind you've seen? It's so early, you know.
Oh, I know. And yet, Veronica, we are knee-deep in presidential politics.
That we are. Well, more to come there, obviously. And speaking of Governor Walker, he is in New Hampshire. What's the governor doing there?
Right. So the governor is making his first trip to New Hampshire as a presidential contender. It's a state that has a lot of significance. It is at the beginning of the primary calendar. And thus, candidates depend on a win there, or at least they want a good showing. They want to end up in second or maybe third place. Because doing so really provides some nice early momentum in the primary season.
Yeah, I've read that ideally a candidate would either take New Hampshire or take Iowa, but yeah, it's got to be one or the other.
Exactly. Either one, it really helps. It helps with fundraising. It helps with getting supporters. It helps with the grassroots. And so you'll see Governor Walker and others looking for this nomination really spending a lot of time in New Hampshire and Iowa in particular.
And what's on the governor's schedule while he's in New Hampshire?
Governor Walker is meeting with former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu, former U.S. Senator Scott Brown, Republican Party county chairs, some editorial boards, and others. By all accounts, he's got a very busy schedule there, and he'll be joined by other possible contenders as well. So he won't be the only hopeful, GOP hopeful, in New Hampshire this weekend.
And we'll leave it there for this week. Noah, thanks a lot for stopping by.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Veronica.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky reviewing the top headlines from around the state this week on our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. The UW system continues to prepare for the possibility of a significant budget cut as the state legislature considers the biennial budget. Meanwhile, at UW-Eau Claire, Chancellor James Schmidt announced that voluntary separation incentives will be offered to eligible faculty and staff. Here to give us the latest on that story is Rich Kramer, WPR News reporter in Eau Claire. Rich, hi.
Hey.
Well, the UW-Eau Claire campus is offering voluntary separation incentives. That's one word. Another term is buyout to some faculty and staff. What do we know about the plan so far?
Well, they're being very careful about what they call it, first of all. The way I understand it, there may be some legal issues if they call it a buyout or if they call it early retirement. But anyway, yeah, they're calling it early incentivized retirement or early separation. It's to address what will be a projected $12 million deficit at UW-Eau Claire that would begin July 1st. Now that, if you break it down, it's $4.5 million for a budget shortfall that they have right now. And if Governor Walker's $300 million cut to the UW system stays the way it is, if the lawmakers don't change it at all, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau has broken that down to about $7.6 million in cuts for UW-Eau Claire, so total $12 million. Basically, they're looking to save money without having to do layoffs or across-the-board cuts, because Chancellor Schmidt has said that that would be more painful than what he's proposing. So basically, they'll give a half a year's pay to folks that are 55 years of age or older that are invested in the Wisconsin retirement system, meaning they've worked at the university for more than 5 years. So they get the half year's pay if they retire early or if they resign.
And it sounds like this is going to be extended to some 325 faculty and staff. Does that seem like a large number?
It's a very large number, and the chancellor made it very clear that he couldn't even if he wanted to offer this to that many people. So what they had to do is they had to give it to everybody that technically qualified. Again, we're talking about legal definitions and whatnot. So they identified 325 employees that would be eligible out of the total of 1,400 employees. So they'll be eligible to apply for this early separation, or this incentivized separation. And then it's up to the administration to figure out, well, what is the most strategic way to where can we cut without damaging a program or where can we get the most savings?
It sounds like there's a couple committees in place to look at that strategic aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, they've got the quick action or the fast action task forces. Ever since the budget address came out, and even before that, I'm sure universities like UW-Eau Claire have been having many, many meetings to prepare. Chancellor Schmidt said that he put out a kind of a challenge to all the different departments for them to look at, you know, the possibility of having to cut 10, 15, 20%, et cetera, and then offer their plans to him so he can kind of pick and choose, I guess.
Do we know how much of UW-Eau Claire's budget goes to salaries of faculty and staff?
Yes, it's around 80 to 90%. It's a huge amount. It's by far the biggest amount.
Any reaction from faculty and staff at UW-Eau Claire yet?
Yeah, I spoke with one person. He's the Jeff Peterson is the chair of the political science department. He's also the faculty representative for the faculty senate. And, you know, he said that they knew about this, that there had been discussions. In fact, he mentioned that faculty had been having discussions about this before the administration even brought it up. And he said that this is a preferable, you know, it's kind of the best case of the worst case kind of a scenario. He said this would, you know, people would be making the choice. They wouldn't be being forced out, and that would be a lot better for morale.
Has the chancellor said what impact this could have on student instruction and class availability?
Well, his plan, and he even admitted that this might be people accuse him of being pie in the sky optimist, but his plan is to keep the university as strong, and in fact, have it be stronger in terms of the excellence that it provides. That's part of the mission, part of the motto for UW-Eau Claire. So that's why he's going to be very careful. I said, well, I kept trying to nail him down on what departments are you going to cut, and he said, well, if I've got five people that qualify in political science, there's no way that he says I could. He says I couldn't cut all five. I'd have to pick one there, and it sounds like it's going to be a very painful process and one that they have to complete fairly quickly.
Now, you've talked to the chancellor. Did he give you any indication whether he thinks that other campuses in the UW system might consider this?
He said there's a lot of eyes watching what he's doing. He basically claims that this is the first time that it's been done at UW-Eau Claire, which I'm not sure, and also the first time it's been done in the UW system. But I've heard conflicting stories on that. But a lot of people are watching, so I shot out emails to some of the administration people at every university, you know, at every UW four-year campus and at UW colleges. And I got a couple responses back. Most people said, well, you know, it's one of the things that we've talked about. But specifically, UW Stout got back to me and said, we couldn't do this because we don't have the cash reserves to be able to offer these payouts. So they're kind of in a different position. So it is really going to be campus by campus, whether or not they can afford to do this or whether or not they want to do it this way.
Rich, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
We've been speaking with Rich Kramer, WPR's news reporter in Eau Claire. Now steps toward a more autonomous UW system may have hit a stumbling block at last week's meeting of the UW Board of Regents. The regents said they'd maintain shared governance and faculty tenure, two things the regents would have the authority to change if the proposed state budget passes. And in response, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss questioned the need for system autonomy. He said, "If you don't believe anything needs changing, then why are we giving you an authority?" Karen Herzog joins us now. She's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's higher education reporter. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Karen, let's start with what Assembly Speaker Robin Voss had to say about the UW system autonomy. What's his point of view at this point?
Well, I believe he was surprised to hear last week that the Board of Regents passed a resolution endorsing tenure and shared governance, saying, well, if there is a gap between the budget being adopted and a public authority, this quasi-public authority that is the governor's proposed for the UW system, that wouldn't be in place probably for another year, if there were a gap, that they would want the authority to keep tenure and shared governance. And Speaker Voss said that it was his sense that the reason you give the university system authority is to make changes, and he felt that these were major things that they needed to look at and that they needed to change.
Are there other legislators also talking about rolling back autonomy?
I believe there's a fair amount of discussion that there is concern about giving the Board of Regents complete authority, especially over tuition. Governor Walker has said that he would like to see a cap on tuition that would be the rate of inflation if there are any future increases if a public authority were to be in place. And that would not really be in keeping with the idea of a public authority, which is to give them the autonomy to make these decisions, you know, such as making up the revenue if they have, not enough money from the state that they would want the ability to raise tuition. Of course, that makes people really nervous because the fear is that if there are several years of tuition freezes and the Board of Regents got authority to raise it, that it would be a large increase.
On the other hand, if the autonomy offer gets walked back a bit, does that mean the UW budget cut might be lessened?
Perhaps. Speaker Voss did indicate yesterday that his goal, his big priority is to reduce that cut. And now he specified that he is most concerned about the smaller campuses, the ones that don't have the cash balances that they can draw from to help fill in the gap if they take a cut. And he specifically referred to UW Parkside and Whitewater, which is Whitewater's his alma mater, and some of the other smaller campuses.
Now, by giving the UW more autonomy, it is afforded the ability to choose how to govern itself. Any idea about how that is standing at this point?
Well, there are two new task forces that the Board of Regents will be appointing, and they are specifically looking at tenure and shared governance. So there is still some discussion. While Speaker Voss is concerned that tenure and shared governance would not be done away with, perhaps, under a public authority, there is some discussion about how could those be fine-tuned, because, of course, the policies really haven't changed. They've been in state statute for decades. And there's been some suggestion that perhaps in practice shared governance could be a little bit less frequent meetings. For example, UW System President Ray Cross said, I don't need a committee to tell me what color to paint my office. Now, that was an exaggeration, but there is a sense that sometimes shared governance is, I think he referred to it as participatory management on steroids.
Well, the UW-Madison Faculty Senate and Academic Staff Assembly both voted to oppose the public authority model. What is tension like right now between staff and administration at the UW-Madison campus?
Well, there's a lot of tension on campuses across the state. Madison has been pretty vocal. UW-Milwaukee has also passed resolutions saying that they oppose the public authority, and a big part of why there's the opposition, the concern, is that there isn't a lot of detail. There really is no specific plan saying this is what it's going to look like, and there's no research that says this is how much it's going to save, this is how it's going to benefit the UW system. In fact, for capital projects, if a building project involves state funding, the state would still have some authority over how it's put together.
You know, it sounds like at this point state lawmakers like Robin Voss are keeping a watchful eye on the Board of Regents. What are you expecting to see as next moves are considered from both parties?
Well, the Board of Regents meets again in a few weeks. They will not be meeting in May, but they do meet once more in April and then again in June. June, they'll be approving or making some pretty serious considerations on their budget. So they have to move fairly quickly to figure out how they're going to address these cuts. And again, I think that there really are very few specifics on what campuses are going to do. There's a whole lot of conversation, but I think that there will probably be more known about the specifics of what those cuts could look like if layoffs are in fact a part of this. Those layoff notices would need to go out around the first part of April in order to have the 60 days notice.
So things may happen pretty quickly.
And that's true, yes. And then, and chancellors will tell you that they have to happen quickly because they have to make decisions sooner rather than later for the fall semester. Those decisions on which courses to offer, who's going to teach them, contracts for faculty, those all have to be decided before the end of this academic year. And the state budget won't be approved until probably late June or perhaps even into early July.
Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with Karen Herzog, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's higher education reporter. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out. You're listening to Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is back on Monday. The Institute of Medicine released its report yesterday on the implications of raising the minimum age to buy tobacco. The report used modeling and other methods to predict likely health outcomes if the minimum age was raised to 19, 21, or 25 years, respectively. With us now is Dr. Michael Fiore, professor of medicine at the University of Wisconsin and a member of the Institute of Medicine. He's also the founder and director of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Dr. Fiore, welcome back to Central Time.
Welcome, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, what is the case for raising the minimum legal age to buy tobacco?
Well, this is a report that makes just so much sense. We know that kids who start using tobacco are at incredible risk of lifelong addiction to tobacco. And we know that the adolescent brain is particularly susceptible to addiction to tobacco. So in essence, if we could protect young people from becoming addicted to a substance that's going to kill half of them prematurely if they don't break free of that addiction, we could have an enormous public health impact. And that impact has now been quantified. We know that if we raise the smoking rate to 21 years, we can save more than 200,000 lives among kids who were born between the year 2000 and 2019, an incredible public health impact. And all it's doing is saying, if you want to choose to smoke, you need to wait till you're age 21 to do so. The same thing we do with alcohol.
Why 21? Why not 19 or 25 if you really want to go a little bit older?
Well, I think it's more the fact that we've established 21 is the age for decision-making for a number of behaviors, including in particular alcohol, that has so many parallels to tobacco use. And in addition, we know that the adolescent brain begins to become established by age 21. And that point, decision-making should be more sound.
So is the adolescent brain more predisposed to addiction at younger ages? If a person starts smoking at 19, they're more likely to be addicted to nicotine than if they start smoking when they're 21?
Yeah, we actually have done some research here at Wisconsin that made the dividing point 17, actually. So I could speak to that division of over 17 or under 17. And what we found was that if a kid had a genetic susceptibility, and this is about half of kids in America today, if they had that susceptibility and they got exposed, they even tried tobacco before age 17, their risk of becoming a lifelong addict to nicotine and tobacco was incredibly high. If instead, even for those with this genetic susceptibility, we protected them to over age 17, what we found is that their risk of lifelong addiction was much less.
How new is this information? Tobacco products been around for a long time. Why is this information coming now?
Well, I mean, we've evolved enormously over the last 50 years. You know, if you look back to 1964, 50 years ago, when for the first time we identified tobacco use as a risk factor, almost every year since that point, we've learned more and more about how deadly tobacco actually is. It was only a month ago that a new report published in the New England Journal of Medicine documented new diseases caused by tobacco and an additional 60,000 Americans killed every year. We're now up to more than 500,000 Americans who are killed every year from tobacco. And, you know, as a physician, I'm often concerned that we become numb to these statistics and these numbers. And we got to remember that for every one of these 500,000 deaths, 8,000 of which occur here in Wisconsin, we have a child who's lost a parent. We have a brother who has lost a sibling. We have a friend who's lost a loved one. And these are all deaths that are preventable. And one last point, it's not just death that's the problem with tobacco. For so many people, it's preceded by decades of an inability to function in the way that people like to, being out of breath, being struck with a stroke and the devastation of that, having a heart attack, all of these illnesses that really take the life out of us slowly before we die from tobacco addiction.
Is there any concern that by raising the minimum legal age to buy tobacco to 21, that these products become more seductive because they're not available and therefore, you know, kids, younger people want them more?
Well, the great news is we actually have some real-world experience. I'm going to tell you about the town of Needham, Massachusetts, which made a 21 purchase age for tobacco back in 2005. So at that point, the smoking rate in Needham was about 13% versus about 14% in Massachusetts overall. 5 years later, the smoking rate had declined among, and this is among high school kids, had declined to 7%, and it was still at 12% for the rest of the state. So the rate was cut in half in just 5 years, compared to just going down a percentage point or two for the rest of Massachusetts. So I think that concern, both in Needham and in subsequent towns where this has been implemented, has shown that what it ends up doing is lowering the rate of tobacco use. And here's where it has the biggest effect, actually. Not among people who are 19 to 21 years old, but it lowers the rate of experimenting and becoming addicted to tobacco among kids who are between 14 and 17 years old. Because we know that the 18 and 19-year-olders are buying cigarettes for their younger peers. And what you end up doing is raise that general age that high school kids are able to get cigarettes.
Right, so that's a compelling number. From 7%, it went down from 13.
Yep.
And lots of kids not smoking. Do you know exactly the mechanisms that are in place there? Obviously, the age being raised helps, but do you know what's happening sociologically a little bit more or in the brain?
Yeah. You know, I don't think that we have that kind of fine-grained analysis. But what we do know is that kids start to smoke if their peers are smoking. And if we could raise the age that kids in general are using tobacco, there's going to be a broadening of that impact.
Now, if you're a business owner, a convenience store owner, you may say, this is going to hurt my bottom line, raising the age like this. What do we know about the effects of revenue?
Well, I guess I'd say, you know, for a deadly product that would expose kids to it, I think it's worth even suffering some declines in revenue for that. But an analysis was done and published in the American Journal of Public Health, and it showed that the impact on industry sales of cigarettes would only be 2% if we raise the age of purchasing cigarettes to age 21.
Only 2%.
Only 2%.
Have you heard any response to this so far from business owners or from communities so far?
Well, in communities where it has been implemented, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. In fact, a Gallup survey demonstrated that 70% of Americans favor raising the age of purchasing cigarettes to age 21.
Any idea how much money would be saved in terms of public health costs if this sort of thing were implemented on a broader scale?
The IOM report actually quantified the economic impact. I don't have that number in front of me, but we know that the cost of tobacco use to American society is a number that's so high it's almost hard to get our hands around, about $350 billion a year. A full 12% of all healthcare costs directly caused by smoking. And it doesn't just cause healthcare costs. It also keeps people out of work. The average worker who smokes takes 2 extra sick days per year. The average worker who smokes is 8% less productive than the average worker who doesn't smoke. The average worker who smokes spends 30 minutes per workday on the rituals of smoking. The productivity impacts are so powerful that for most business owners, the benefits of having a smoke-free group of workers are really powerful. If we could offer every business in Wisconsin or the nation an 8% increase in productivity overnight by doing a simple action as helping their employees to quit, I think many of them would take it.
Is there any concern that by raising the age to 21, you said some communities have it, doesn't sound like a lot so far, but that this could be perceived as being too paternalistic, that you're stepping on the toes of a free choice of people who are essentially 18, 19, 20-year-olds, adults by most effective measures in society?
Well, we have lots of measures in our society, public health measures that are designed to ensure that people are as healthy as they can be. I often use this example. If somebody said they wanted to sprinkle asbestos dust around, because asbestos is a legal product, I should be able to sprinkle it around the three of us here this afternoon. You would say, you can't, because that's putting people in danger and putting that person in great danger to him or herself. Similarly, we say that for alcohol, that we have an age of 21 because we know it has an enormous impact on motor vehicle accidents. And I think similarly, knowing that half of the people who become addicted to tobacco are going to die prematurely from it, it's reasonable to not say it's illegal to purchase the product, but you need to wait till you're age 21 to do so.
We're talking about the possible implications of raising the minimum legal age for smoking, for buying tobacco products. And we want to know what you think. Should Wisconsin raise the legal age for tobacco use? What do you think? Would you be willing to give up some of that personal freedom for the benefits of public health? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue our discussion with Dr. Michael Fiore, professor of medicine at the University of Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the possible public health benefits of raising the minimum legal age for buying tobacco products. And you can join our conversation. Were you or was someone in your family an early smoker? And how did it affect aspects like health and nicotine addiction? What do you think are the pros and cons of raising that minimum legal age for tobacco? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Dr. Michael Fiore stays with us. He is professor of medicine at the University of Wisconsin and the founder and director of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. And we go to our phone lines now. Matt is first in Delavan. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just reminded of a few weeks ago, John Oliver did an episode on Last Week Tonight about smoking, and his concentrated on the common package law, which versus increased later ages for purchasing seem to have a lot more effect on the actual smoking rate. Why wouldn't we go after something like that?
All right, thanks, Matt. And the packaging law, first of all, can you tell us what that is, Michael, and then how it might affect?
Yeah, well, could you just, why don't, I'm going to ask the caller to describe from the show what he saw is the packaging law, because there's a couple things about packaging, what cigarettes are packaged in, for example. Could you tell me what he was talking about specifically?
Oh, absolutely. So the common packaging law that they brought up in that episode was the Australia, which has photos, of parts of the face as they would be extremely affected by smoking. So sunken eyes, bad teeth, things like that.
Great. Okay. Thank you. That thing that was on the TV show got a lot of press. It's nice to see that you saw it as well. So the FDA received the capacity to oversee tobacco use in America back in 2009. And part of the legislation, this is federal legislation, allowed them to have warnings on packages that are much broader than the very subtle Surgeon General's warnings that are on the sides of packs today. They actually allowed for the sort of thing that you're describing, very graphic pictures of the outcomes of smoking, a cancerous lung, an individual who has mouth cancer from smoking, etc. That was announced to go into effect in 2010. The tobacco industry has questioned that in court. They've sued the FDA, and it's been tied up in court ever since. So unfortunately, while the legislation said it could happen, it's currently tied up in court. I think it would be a great, very immediate reminder to people who smoke of the impact of tobacco use. But right now it can't happen because of a court ruling.
Okay, well, thank you for the call, Matt. Appreciate that. We're going to go next to Dennis, joining us in Green Bay. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I'm a non-smoker, but I don't believe anybody should smoke, but I don't think you can legislate common sense. If there's laws in place, why do we need more? Let's enforce the ones we have. If you're going to ban it completely, make it so nobody can smoke. I just think people who are adults should be able to make their own decisions without government interfering.
All right. Thank you, Dennis. Much government interference here, Michael.
Yeah. Well, Dennis, I mean, I respect your perspective, and I think some people are going to have different views on this. As someone who has raised a son, I could say that at age 18, my son may have not had as much common sense some days as I wish he would have. And I think a lot of parents may feel the same way, that, holding off until age 21, when our children are able to maybe make more informed decisions, seems like a sensible strategy to most Americans. As I mentioned earlier, 70% of Americans favor increasing the age to 21. And one statistic that I found in the survey really compelling is that 60% of smokers support increasing the age of smoking to 21. And, I'm a physician who helps people quit every day, and this makes a lot of sense to me because almost every smoker I treat tells me the same thing. I so hate the day that I started this. I wish I had never started. I started when I was 15, I was 17, I was 18. I wish I had never started. And to hold that off until age 21 seems like a reasonable public health approach that's supported by 70% of Americans in general and even by 60% of smokers.
Dennis, thanks for the call. And we're going to go next to Thomas. Thomas joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Thomas.
Good afternoon, Veronica, Michael. It's a pleasure to be on the show. I have a question why, in the discussion of tobacco, hardly any attention is brought to chewing tobacco. And it's so pervasive now because so many young men and maybe some women view it as a safer alternative to cigarettes. And I'm wondering what the the doctor feels about chewing tobacco.
Okay, thanks for bringing that up, Thomas. Chewing tobacco.
Yeah, Tom, thanks for giving us that perspective. You're right. Particularly in rural Wisconsin, the rates of smokeless or chew tobacco use by young men is quite high. In some of the surveys, 15 to 20% of them are using smokeless tobacco products. Smokeless tobacco is not a safe alternative to cigarettes. It causes a lot of problems, particularly cancers to the mouth, in the upper airway, in the esophagus. It doesn't cause some of the other problems of tobacco, like heart attacks and strokes, but it is not a safe alternative. And in my view, if we were to raise the age of tobacco use, it should be for all tobacco products to 21.
Okay, thank you for the call, Thomas. We appreciate that. And a comment here from Wesley, and I'm going to paraphrase wildly. It's a long comment. But Wesley essentially is saying that we're inconsistent in what we tell young people about what they can and cannot do, that they can join the military when they're younger than this proposed smoking age. They can get a job when they're 16 years old, contribute to society. But then on the other hand, we turn around and say, you know, but you still can't smoke. Sorry, you're not old enough to do that. What about the consistency of messaging? It's a big question, but what about that?
Well, I think it's a point well taken, except that, you know, what in our life is entirely consistent? And I go back to alcohol. As a society, we've made a decision that the downside to allowing teenagers to purchase alcohol does not outweigh, or in fact outweighs, the consistency of letting people at 18 or even 16 use alcohol. I think this is a similar situation, and it is because of solely one thing. The health outcomes are so substantial, and the susceptibility of teenagers is so great that it's an action that I believe is warranted.
And as we get toward the end of our time together, e-cigarettes a little bit more. We've seen a big rise in them, a lot of establishments opening, selling e-cigarettes, some studies coming out showing that there might not be a clear picture about health implications. Should we be rolling e-cigarettes into this more?
Well, e-cigarettes is a giant topic, and it's one of the topics that probably has the most discussion and the least science to guide us. E-cigarettes have only been around for about 5 to 7 years, generally available. For an individual, they're probably safer than smoking combustible cigarettes, but are they an entirely safe product? Probably not. And until we know, why would we want to use a product that is potentially dangerous, particularly when there are other medications to help people to quit that have been tested by the FDA and shown to be safe and effective?
And as we wrap up, just briefly, you've made a career out of helping people to stop smoking. What resources are out there if someone hears this and they're motivated to quit?
Yeah. So, you know, so many Wisconsin residents who smoke want to quit. And to each of you, even if you've tried and have failed, keep at it. It takes many people 4, 5, 6 or more times. For everyone, we have available the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Anyone can call and get free counseling, 2 weeks of free medication. The second option, talk to your doctor. She may be able to give you some of the new treatments that are available. And finally, go onto the web. Smokefree.gov is a free quitting service from the National Cancer Institute. If you're ready to quit, there are a lot of resources to help you to do so.
Dr. Fiore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Dr. Michael Fiore, professor of medicine at the University of Wisconsin, founder and director of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.